My guest at this time is Christopher Horner. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is also the author of multiple books on the climate change debate, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism and Power Grab, How Obama's Green Policies Will Steal Your Freedom and Bankrupt America. You can get an idea where he comes down on this issue. We want to get his insights into what is being advocated at the Climate Summit in Paris and what it will mean for our day-to-day lives. And Chris, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
President Obama's message this week is that this is a problem that cannot be confronted too late and something must be done now. That's his big message this week. We know about the Obama administration's regulations, or at least their proposed regulations on water and ozone and carbon emissions. What else does he want to do?
Well, he wants to agree to a treaty that on its face, buried on the first page, tightens every 5 years. So I think if you just look at what the EPA regulations, which are now in court, but anyway, the big global warming rules, those don't even get him to what he's promising in Paris on behalf of the United States and in what really needs to be viewed as a State of the Union address to foreigners, saying a list of things he wants Congress to do, but it can't promise anybody with any authority. So what he's saying is, I'm going to do whatever I can use the federal government to do. We've seen, I mean, it's exhaustive to say, but you go through all of the alphabet soup agencies, and they are being used. So it's a lot more than just EPA. It's the Tennessee Valley Authority. It is the FERC, the Energy Regulatory Commission. It is the Department of Energy and Department of Agriculture. This is one reason it's so appealing to the ruling class, is because it is the bottomless well of programs, because nothing ever proposed would actually, even according to the alarmists, detectably impact climate. So there's always more to do.
What's their answer to that? Not that that's your job to figure it out, but when they can't even promise that anything will change, given all these major changes and the impact it'll have on everyone's life, what's their answer?
It's not very satisfying from a logical perspective, because they run at you because, look, no free society would actually do to itself what this requires. Europe is cheating. The rest of them refuse. So let's not say others are doing it. What they say is, Japan walked away, Canada walked away. What they say is, well, even though we just said the world's on fire, 10 years Miami will be underwater, sign here, details to follow. You point out that even their own computer models, which are proved wrong, say this won't impact the climate, so why don't you leave a wealthier world to deal with things that aren't, they're not outside natural cycles. But anyway, something we always face, which is changing climate, often severe, always unpredictable weather, they say, well, we have to do something. It's a start. We must act now. Now, wait a second. It was a moral imperative to start. The time is at hand. Miami will be underwater in 10 years. Here's your solution. If it's a moral issue, how do you propose something that will do nothing? I think maybe it's not about the climate. It's not rationally about the climate. And so I haven't heard an answer other than, well, arms crossed, we must do something. This isn't something. But these policies have been proved to kill people because of energy poverty. You can just search it. It's all over the English language media in Germany, England, Ireland, it's Scotland. It's killing people. Since neither of us are actually going to impact the climate with our proposal for this claim, why don't we just stop killing people? First, do no harm. That's a tough one for them to answer.
Chris, I realize you wrote a whole book with this subtitle, but just to summarize it in a thumbnail way for our listeners, you talked about climate poverty and how it's claiming lives. I'd like you to expand a little bit on that and how else you think our freedom and our prosperity will be threatened by this.
Okay, so the president, remember, these rules, this treaty, all of this is to put into place, to implement the promise to, quote, bankrupt a legitimate industry to cause electricity rates to necessarily skyrocket. His term, and necessarily is the more important word, necessarily. Okay, what happens when you do that? Because remember, seniors, the poor, anybody on a low and fixed income pay a much greater percentage of their income for heating and eating. Well, as headline after headline, and you can see the video of some of these at Energy and Environment Legal's YouTube page, show, in Ireland, a third of seniors are choosing between heating and eating. And if they choose to stay alive at night, then they have to forego eating. We used to hear this claim about medicine. Well, this is heating and eating, and it's proved in the countries the president used to tell us to look to because they're implementing these policies. It's called energy poverty. They spend a spectacular amount of their income on heating, and in fact, as you'll see in this video, they're burning books. Bookstore employees are giving interviews saying, I think burning books is wrong, but the seniors are trying to stay alive. They really like these hardback, thick books like War and Peace, so they come in to stay alive at night, so who are we to judge? This is serious. This is a direct result of government policy, and the numbers have spiked. according to the UK government, Hill's fuel poverty study, the left-wing newspapers, the Telegraph, you name it, they all say it has spiked, coincident with these policies, such that now they expect 40,000 excess winter deaths just in England and Wales, excess, and they had predicted maybe 2,000 before these policies came into effect. Then it spiked, and they say half of these are people dying of hypothermia in their apartments. You're killing people for no impact on climate. It's a cruel gesture. I know it feels good. It's politically fashionable in some circles. But there are real human impacts from, you have to just think, what is the logical outcome of vowing to cause people's energy prices to skyrocket? If you're rich, you may not consider it, but not everybody is.
Chris, given this track record, ultimately they're going to run out of money because people are going to die, as you've pointed out, and they're going to run out of money as they pay their high costs. So eventually they're not going to be able to pay for all this. Then what?
Well, what we've seen so far is it leads to the same groups that caused the problem to, as speaking of cyclical things, to then come to the state and say, you must do something about the fuel poverty deaths epidemic. The Guardian in the UK has a story about the scandal of UK's fuel poverty deaths, and they say the solution isn't to undo what causes it, but to provide more money for insulation and so on. More programs in the name of the same thing is probably not the most efficient response to policies that we now know are killing people. What we've seen is it just leads to the same people demanding more policies and more money. Instead of that, undo what we've seen causes this horror. It was a horror when 20,000 French seniors died during a heat wave. Why is it not a horror when that many are dying every single year as a direct result of government policies, country by country throughout Europe, because it's the wrong temperature, because it's cold, not warm? It's still a horror, and it's easily resolved. Just by the way, the reason seniors die during heat waves in societies that have made electricity so expensive they don't have a $130 air conditioning unit is because they can't pay to run it.
Just a couple of quick questions before we let you go, Chris. Is there really fierce debate going on in Paris right now, or is this just 2 weeks of posturing and most of these people are already well on board with whatever's going to come out here in a few days?
It's largely stitched up. There are a couple of things they're haggling over, and it comes down to what an email I obtained through litigation with the State Department, reported by the Washington Times on Monday of this week, showed. The White House emailed at midnight with their climate negotiator saying, the UN General Assembly President was just asked by Senator Markey, what do we have to do to get a climate treaty? And he said one word, money. That's what it's about. They've actually added a court into the draft now called the International Climate Justice Tribunal to threaten us so that they'll say, think of the uncertainty, how much you would have to pay for every weather event that occurs everywhere in the world, because you're agreeing in this document you caused it. Why don't you just agree to what's called the Green Climate Fund, $100 billion per year to start? That is the sole real item for negotiation right now, and there are three things tied up with one, the fund, whether we pay for everybody's weather, and a court to adjudicate that, or do we just agree to the fund? That's what the next 10 days to 2 weeks will be about.
And I guess the last question is the president, of course, has said this is not a treaty, much like he did with the Iran deal. The question is, do you think Republicans in Congress have learned anything from the Iran deal episode? Will they essentially come up with another Corker-type piece of legislation? Will this be fought in court? What do you think the response is going to be here?
I don't think that this could be fought in court. Well, you could try, but I assume that the court would kick it down as a political question. The Senate has a shared role in the treaty process. If they don't speak up, then we're all going to have to pay the price. I don't think they'll vote a la Corker to vote away their sovereignty. But the question is whether, as with the Kyoto Treaty, they stand up on their hind legs and say, you don't have the right to say something's not a treaty. It is if we say it is, just like it is if you say it is. And you can't avoid the Constitution just by declaring what is obviously a treaty by saying it isn't. So in the next 2 weeks, or I'm now hearing after Paris, they're going to decide whether to adopt a resolution saying, sorry, world, you shouldn't have taken him seriously. It has to go through us first. That's the big domestic political question.
Chris, a lot to keep watch of. Thanks very much for being with us as always.
Thank you, Greg.
Christopher Horner is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the author of multiple books on the climate change debate, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Global Warming and Environmentalism, and Power Grab, How Obama's Green Policies Will Steal Your Freedom and Bankrupt America. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.